me up here without playing some sort of Disney movie. And you were wrong. The record scratch freeze frame is a movie cliche, a cinematic cliche that became popularized during the 80s and 90s. And what it is it features in the cliche typically like a record scratching, like the, you know, the record, that was my best impression, of a record scratching and then like the movie freezing and then usually the protagonist saying, you probably wonder how I got to this moment. And in the same way that we see one of my favorite movies, that's actually, I think, my favorite Disney movie, showing that example of kind of like starting in the middle of the story and then showing the rest of the movies kind of leading up to that point, and then it kind of shows how that protagonist responds. And the author or the director, whoever was their creative decision to make that happen, they used that to not let that be the focus. They didn't want it to be the focus of the movie, so that's why they put it at the beginning. So the focus is really the author or the creative director is asking the question, like, how did the protagonist get to this point? How did they get here? What led up to this moment? And that's the important part that the rest of the movie kind of spends a lot talking about. But then the even more important part is how did that protagonist respond? So we know Emperor Cusco, he got to that point because he was a punk, right? Like, he didn't get to that point by being the nicest guy in town. No, he got to that point by being a punk, by being very self-centered, very conceited. An emperor, like, I think that's kind of how most emperors are probably like. He got to that point by being conceited, and then the rest the movie, after it catches up to that point in time, is him responding to what got him into that same situation. And what we see is that in Acts, we actually have what I think is kind of like a record scratch freeze frame moment, and that's in Acts 19 through 20. So let me read that for you. The words will be up on the screen if you don't have a Bible in front of you. I'll be reading from the ESV. I have one of the handy-dandy things that Tom has. I actually use these in my high school youth group. We're going through Romans right now, and I have the entire New Testament in these. And I do my entire, like, not all my message prep, but I do, like, all of my, like, chicken scratching in one of these for Romans. So when I flip back, we're about halfway through, I have all of Romans, just, like, a bunch of notes of, like, what does justification mean? I have all these different things that I'm underlining. So I highly recommend using one of these if you feel like that your regular Bible is, like, too holy to put pen in or something. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I spent too much money on this thing to be scratching it up. So I highly recommend one of these for your study. But let me start in Acts 14. 19 and 20. This is God's word. But Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having persuaded the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing he was dead. But when the disciples gathered about him, he rose up and entered the city, and on the next day, he went on with Barnabas to Derbe. Tom told me to say, pronounce Derbe as brrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr smarter than me, so I'm going to trust him, but I was too nervous to say that on my own. But we see this moment of Paul being stoned. We know that as far as at least in 2 Corinthians, that this is the first time that he's been stoned and most likely the last. There could be a time that he was stoned after that he's writing to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians, but most likely not. So this is some time that he was stoned, and it's extreme. Most of us, I'm always afraid that someday I'm going to put my foot in my mouth and feel really bad, but I think because we're all in this room still breathing, there's a good chance that none of us have been stoned. And so this idea of receiving intense persecution to the point where Paul is being stoned, that should be like, whoa, what is going on there? In the same way that when a cartoon throws a talking, meeping llama up on the screen, you go, okay, what's going on? Like, that's not normal. You guys are farmers in Silverton, so you probably have some llamas in the area, and you've probably, hopefully, never heard a llama speak. Now, if you have, either you need medical attention, or you should show me that llama, because that's really cool. But we can look at this as it's an important part. It's extreme, and Luke, the author of this text, is using that very intentionally. But what we notice that is that it's only two verses, and there's not a lot of detail in it. And so what we see is that Luke is not trying to draw attention to that. He's trying to draw the attention to how Paul got to this point. So just like in our Emperor's New Groove video, we need to go back to the beginning. Not that far. That's way too far. Let's go to Acts 1:8. And this is the Great Commission. I had Rock read us another version of the Great Commission because I think the contrast between them is really important. But we're going to be looking at Acts 1:8. And it says, "But you will receive the power when the Holy Spirit comes on you. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." So at this point, Jesus sets forth a ripple effect, a butterfly effect of this little thing that he says is going to change the rest of the world. In fact, I don't think that there's ever been a group of people that got together and organized and had a mission statement that has made a greater impact on the world. I think that you guys would all agree with me. This was a very important part. And from here, what we see is that Paul is not in this moment, but the next time we see Paul or Saul, the first time we see him is at the stoning of Stephen. And he might not be necessarily complicit in that moment, but he's at least implicit. He's there and he's observing. He didn't stand up and do anything. And I think that that moment really shaped him. I think that as a young man looking at other people stoning Stephen, that probably shaped the rest of his ministry, especially before he became a believer and was persecuting other believers. From there, we see Paul converted. In that moment, Paul's actually kind of sent with what Jesus says to Paul. He's like, "You're going to go somewhere, and then I'm going to send you somewhere else to do my mission." And then from there, we kind of see a lot of what Tom has been talking about and what Paul's journey has been, and that he's been seeing, Paul has been meeting miraculous acceptance and radical rejection. So far, that's been what the story is. And that brings us to our text, which I'm going to read for you again. Again, the words will be up on the screen, and we'll be reading in Acts 14:8-10. "Now at Lystra, there was a man sitting who could not use his feet. He was crippled from birth and had never walked. He listened to Paul speaking, and Paul, looking intently at him and seeing he had faith to be made well, said in a loud voice, 'Stand upright on your feet.' And he sprang up and began walking." I have been able to walk for not all my life, but the majority of it. And so I don't think I'll ever get to know what this guy experienced, but I imagine that it was great joy. So we've talked a little bit about how we got to our passage. Let's talk about how our passage got us to where Paul was being stoned. And the first thing that we see is that Paul proclaims the gospel. What we see in this passage right here that I think is important, and also most of the scholarly people that I read kind of prepping for this also kind of thought was important, is that this is one of the first times we see Paul go to a place and there's not a synagogue. So normally, Paul would go somewhere and he'd go to the synagogue first because that's where the people that he was familiar with would be at, and he would proclaim the gospel to them. And that kind of got him in a lot of trouble. I think it was good trouble, but in a lot of trouble. And so we don't see him going to a synagogue. So what we can assume about this place in Lystra was that there wasn't very many Jews. I tried to quickly Google how many Jews there needed to be in an area for it to be like mandated that there needed to be a synagogue. I know I learned this one time in my Pentateuch class, but I couldn't find it really quickly, and it's not the point of this text. But know that there's a number that there would have needed to have been. Like, I can't remember, it was like 8 families. That's kind of what I want to say, but I could be wrong, so don't quote me on that. But we see that this area is not very Jewish. So this would have been people unfamiliar to them. So I don't know what unfamiliar people would be like to you. Maybe you don't have to go very far in Silverton to find people unlike you. Maybe you have to go all the way to Salem to find people unlike you. Maybe you have to go all the way to Portland, but it's probably not too far. This place, Lystra, would have been very different from what Paul was probably used to, at least as a Jew. And what we see, what does he do? He proclaims the gospel. Paul proclaims the gospel. You might be looking at me right now, and it doesn't say that in the text. It says that Paul was speaking, and I just want to ask you guys, well, what do you think? He was talking about the Blazers or the Seahawks? Like, the Blazers and the Seahawks probably aren't worth talking about too much when you get together with a bunch of people and talk about spiritual things in our time, but they certainly weren't around in Paul's day. And what we see Paul having a pattern of is talking about the gospel, talking about God. And so Paul, to get up in front of a platform of a bunch of people and not speak the gospel is very unlikely. So we see in this passage, in this first portion in 8-10, that Paul is proclaiming the gospel. And he doesn't just do this. We're going to talk about this being an important part of Paul's ministry later, but he doesn't just use words, he uses actions. He, through the Holy Spirit, through Jesus, is able to provide healing for a man. He is able to love through his ministry. So Paul's not only proclaiming the gospel, but he's loving people through his ministry. And when we see that, we see that the crowd goes nuts. We see that the people get so excited. They're like, "Wow, this is ridiculous. We've never seen this." And they make a big mistake, is what we see in the second part of our passage. And in our second part of the passage, we see that Paul is proclaiming the gospel again. Let me read this for you. This should be verses 11 through 18. I shouldn't have closed this book. Starting in verse 11. "And when the crowds saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in Lycaonian, 'The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men.' Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. And the priest of Zeus, whose temple was at the entrance to the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifices with the crowds. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their garments and rushed out into the crowd, crying out, 'Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and when we bring you good news, that you should turn from these vain things to a living God, who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways. Yet he did not leave himself without a witness, for he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying you your hearts with good or with food and gladness. Even with these words, they scarcely restrained the people from offering sacrifices to them." There's a lot that we can get from this passage here in the second part of that passage. But what really stands out to me is I have proclaimed the gospel a few times, and no one's ever called me a Greek god. And I was at first kind of like offended, like, man, no one's giving me that kind of a title. But really, this is a gross misunderstanding of what Paul and Barnabas were communicating. And Paul and Barnabas, they react in a very important way. They did what we see Jewish people doing sometimes is tearing their garments. And that's specifically a trend that Jewish people would do when they heard like blaspheming or heresy about God. And I think what's important to know is like, I don't know what your tradition is when you hear blaspheming or heresy about God, but it's not like that public. I might be like, "Oh, okay, yeah, I don't believe that," and like shy away. But I love how Paul and Barnabas just like supermaned into this scene by just tearing off their clothes in a stark contrast to what they were hearing these people say. What's important to notice in 11 through 18 is not only is there not a synagogue, but there's also a temple specifically to the Greek god Zeus. I am extremely fascinated by Greek culture. I think it's really cool that Greek culture lines up with actually Norse mythology, and Greek mythology and Norse mythology doesn't. They're like kind of far apart. Like on the world scale, they're not that far apart. But back then in the known world, they were kind of like at the ends of the known world. And they actually have really similar mythologies. And what I love is that they both have a flood account. So if that isn't like some great apologetics for you, I don't know what is. But we see that there's a temple, which only means that these people are not super Jewish, but it means that they're also really Greek. So coming with a Greek temple, these Greek people would have had Greek culture, Greek religion, and Greek laws. So they would have been people that were very, very different than Paul's traditional upbringing. And what does Paul do during this? He preaches the gospel again. We see that Jesus... Well, we don't. That's the point, is that where does he say Jesus in his gospel presentation? He doesn't use the word Jesus. Where is Jesus' death and resurrection? Well, apparently, and at least what Luke recorded and what he thought was important about Paul's gospel presentation was that he didn't include Jesus' name. And I think that that can be an important reminder for us that the gospel doesn't have to be that small part of about Jesus. It's a very critical and important part about it. And if we were to have a holistic approach to what the gospel is, it should include that. But maybe it doesn't need to every single time we talk about the gospel. How do the people respond? If this is the acceptance where they think that not only what Paul and Barnabas are saying is awesome, but thinking them of them as gods. Here's down here where they stone Paul. I actually don't think that they're down here. I think that they're somewhere kind of in the middle, and they're like, eh. Because it says that they were barely able to prevent them from stoning, able to prevent them from sacrificing to them. So we see that they're like still not convinced. Like even though you're lying at this point, they think, like, we think you're Greek gods and we think that you're lying, but even though you're a Greek god and you lie, you can kind of see that, like, confusing. These people were just heavily confused. But now we have finally caught up to the moment where we refer to this record scratch, freeze frame moment where Paul is being stoned. We see Paul being stoned, but what's important to me, I think, in this passage is that we see the Jews came from another area. So that also points to the fact that there were probably no Jews in this area, and they come to this area and they persecute. And I think that that's kind of like, these Jews were determined. Not only was there going to be like no heretical preaching in their views in their areas, they were like determined to go to other areas to prevent that. I can think of some churches in our world that will go to great distances to like picket and to talk badly about other people. I think if I actually remember correctly, there's been a church that's come and done that from across the nation here in Silverton. So that's our story. We see this stark contrast between what originally happened when Paul presented the gospel and then what happened again after he presented the same gospel a second time. Two very different responses. And I think that Luke is using this structure of the story for us to look back and go, whoa, what happened? How did we get here? And so we've kind of answered how we got there. And it's that Paul proclaimed the gospel a couple times. So what does this mean? And I think the first thing that it means is that the gospel brings record-breaking results. I'm going to use the word record a bunch of different times today, and I'm going to use it kind of interchangeably. And I'm doing that on purpose to kind of trick you, to make sure that you're following along. But also by the end of my sermon, maybe you're tired of hearing the word record, and we'll talk about that. But anyway, we see in the beginning that the gospel brings record-breaking results. It's story time. When I was in eighth grade, I broke a school record. I don't know if you can tell by looking at me, but I used to be kind of fast. So I was at least the fourth fastest person in my grade in eighth grade, and I ran the 100 relay. So I handed off a baton, and I was like, stick, you know, so if you've ever been in, no one's ever done track? Okay. But anyway, so that's what you do in track, at least if you're on a relay team. You hand off a baton, and I was on this relay team, and we ended up breaking the school record. So I got to have my name and some other people's names, I know. Okay, but up on a little plaque that was stuck on the record, my dad was the coach, and he disagrees. He thinks that his name should be up there, but apparently his record got lost somewhere because he went to the same school. Some, like, Locreal middle school drama. So I broke that record, and it was pretty cool. I got to, like, strut around the middle school and be like, I have a record. And it was pretty cool. It was, like, able to look back and say, man, this feat that I did is able to be remembered by this intense performance, and it was able to break a record. And I have that plaque, actually, somewhere. I thought about taking a picture for it or of it. But since Hannah and I are kind of like in the process of moving, it's packed up somewhere. I don't know where it's at, but I'll have to show our students someday that I was able to run a relay in like 52 seconds or something, 400-meter relay. But the reason I have that is because the record's been broken. So they took it down, and then they handed it to me. They're like, your record's been broken. And I was like, I used to be cool. So this is like my badge to say I used to be cool and one of the fastest people the school's ever had. And the worst person in the whole world broke it. There is no worst person that can break one of your records. It was my younger brother and his relay team. So that is a permanent reminder that I am the second best son in our family. But what we see is we see that the gospel brings record-breaking results. So on one hand, we see this dichotomy. I think you can go ahead and throw that up there, maybe. Yeah, so we see this dichotomy of extreme acceptance and extreme rejection. And that crown represents the gospel because I think that ultimately the gospel is the declaration of Jesus' divinity and rightful lordship over the earth. Now, it has ramifications that are incredibly important in our identity and purpose, but to summarize it, it's that Jesus is king. He's God. He's Lord. And so when we look at this crown, when we take it, the same thing comes and leads to either that radical or miraculous acceptance or radical rejection. So we have this dichotomy, this difference between them. And in the acceptance, we see that Paul heals a guy and everyone wants a slice of that goodness. So when there are good things happening and people are like, I want to be healed. Like if he was able to walk, imagine what Paul could do with me. I could already walk. He could make me fly or something, right? So they see this goodness and they want a part of it. And that's, I think, is an appropriate response to the gospel. Even though the gospel doesn't always heal us in that way, it can heal us in other ways too, and I think it's a good thing that we want to be healed from the gospel. And so, of course, there should be acceptance to the gospel, because it meets so many of our needs ultimately. I hope that you guys are able to nod your head to that. I hope you're able to look back on your life and say, yeah, the gospel provides everything for me. It declares who I am, not only ultimately, but into God. Who I am to God, the gospel declares that I'm a child of God, that I am justified, that I'm made righteous, that I am not only innocent, but so much more than that in the presence of God. So of course, when people hear the gospel and understand it for what it is, of course there'd be acceptance. But we also see the rejection. The rejection of that is they stone Paul. That's pretty radical rejection. I've shared the gospel with people and they've rejected it and I've never been stoned. And I felt like my persecution and rejection at the time was really scary. And honestly, it was hard for me. So that's not to take away from anyone else's persecution, but this is record breaking persecution. At least for Paul, it's a PR, it's a personal record. Even though my middle school record was broken, I never ran track again. Well, I did in high school, but at least as an eighth grader, that's my personal record for that relay as an eighth grader. I never broke that record again. And Paul's PR for persecution is being stoned. And when I read this, I kind of think immediately, like, where was Barnabas? Like, how did he get out of being stoned? And I couldn't find anything about, this is another thing that I don't think is super important to what I have to say today, but at least kind of caught my eye. And there's probably like one of my students that was like, well, of course, Andrew, he was in line at Starbucks. Like, what else would you think? Like, that's exactly where he was. But I think it's kind of convenient that Paul or Barnabas got out of that. But when we look at it and we see the rejection, we have to understand that, of course, the gospel is going to bring rejection. People are going to reject the gospel. It is, by nature, countercultural. Well, let's think about that for a second. Maybe we, as people who are hopefully understanding the gospel, believe its truth, or like, no, it makes sense. But let's think about it. If the gospel wasn't countercultural, and cultures were already doing what the gospel asked us to do, then Jesus wouldn't have needed to come and die for us. We would have already had it figured out. So of course, the gospel is countercultural. God sent the gospel because things weren't right. Because things needed to change. And what's really important to understand, and where this little doodle I made in PowerPoint in about 5 minutes, is that different results come from the same product. Different results come from the same product. It's the same gospel that Paul presented multiple times, and people rejected it or accepted it depending on what God was doing in their life. We're going to talk about this a little bit later as we kind of get to how do we apply this. But ultimately, people's response to the gospel is ultimately dependent on what God is doing and what he's going to provide. Now, there are other things. I could get up in front of some people and share the gospel and do it really poorly, and maybe God decides not to use that in a way, but ultimately it's what he does. Because there have been times where I have presented the gospel really poorly, and at least in my opinion, I just stumbled all over my words and probably spoke too fast like I am doing maybe right now. And I maybe did some things that maybe didn't turn people onto the gospel in the right way, but God, I know, has used it. So ultimately, the response to the gospel is from God. And what's important to know that we're going to really talk about later, so you guys are going to have to use your patience, is that if we don't, there are other things that can lead to both of those responses. People can accept Christians for other things than our gospel proclamation, and I think that that can be a little scary. I think that we should be hesitant to look at the response that people give, and if it's for something else besides the proclamation of the gospel, I think that necessarily we should just cut that out as like, don't ever do that. But I think that we should be hesitant and go, Is this acceptance receiving the acceptance we want if it's for something other than the gospel? Is this rejection we're receiving if it's from something else besides the gospel, something we want? So the gospel brings record-breaking results. Second, we see that the gospel demands broken record repetition. I know that there are probably youth pastor stereotypes in your mind that you already have, and I'm not going to list them all out because they would hurt my feelings probably, but I know what a record player is, so that might be surprising to you guys, but I'll be willing to admit the only reason I really know what one looks like and how it works is because I have one, and I only have one because they got really retro and really cool. Like, they're really not, like, the best way to play music. They're like, right? They're not, like, the best way, but they became kind of retro popular again, and so everyone would, like, post them on their little Instagrams. Like, I got my record player. It sounds really bad, but it looks cool and photogenic. But a record is spiraled, right? So it starts at one spot, and it spirals, and it takes the needle, and it takes it to the end. And I'm, like, thinking in my head, like, where do you start it? You start it at the middle. So you start at the middle, and it spirals out, right? Yeah? No? Oh, so you start at the end? The outside. Gosh dang, I should have practiced at home before I got here. The important part is that it's spiraled, and because of its spiraled nature, if it gets scratched, it can what? It can loop, right? It can kind of go back to the same spot. I know what that's like because I've had broken records that have looped because I probably took bad care of our records. But guys, that's the idea that we should be as gospel proclaimers, that it should be on a broken record repetition. Yeah, go ahead and throw that up there. I'm actually trying to hypnotize you. But the gospel needs to be on loop in our heart, minds, and lives. And we can see this. I'm not making this up. Let's look at it in our passage. So if you flip your Bibles open again, we can see that in verse 7 of 14, right before our section, it says they continued to preach the gospel. In 8 through 10, we see that Paul is preaching the gospel again. And then right after that, in the section where they tear their garments, they preach the gospel. We see that. And then after that, Barnabas picks Paul up off the ground and maybe some other disciples, and they go to another place to preach the gospel. So no matter what is going on in your life, no matter what sort of persecution or acceptance you are receiving, you are to continue proclaiming the gospel. And I think ultimately what this passage means is that when we as a church have gospel proclamation on repeat, not only in our church, but in our lives and out for the world, the church grows. Isn't that the message of Acts? Isn't that what Tom has been showing us in Acts, is that when the gospel is proclaimed and it reaches new people, the church grows. The church grows. The third thing that we see is that the gospel is a remaster of the old record. A remaster is like a redoing of a song that is like too old to continue like sounding correctly, so they remaster it. So go ahead and throw those old people up. I'm not totally convinced that there actually was music back then, this record says that this is, and it's a remaster of an old record from the Beatles, and so they like kind of do their best to blow the dust off of it and then like reship it. And honestly, they mostly redo it to like make money again. Like, they already made money off of you Beatle fans once, probably twice, three times, four times. So they're just trying to cash out and get more money. But in reality, it does sound better. And the gospel is a remaster of the old record in that it has always been God's plan for God's people to bring blessing to all the nations. It's always been that way. And his promise to Abraham, I don't even know if it's a promise. It's more of like a promise and a command. He says that my people are going to bring blessings to all the nations. And it's kind of like a promise that, Abraham, your descendants are going to be the agents in that, but also I'm going to be the one that provides a blessing. So it's like a command for Abraham to be that blessing, but that God is going to promise to bring that blessing. And this gets us back to Acts 1:8. You don't have to put it up there, but it gets us back to that Acts 1:8 of that pattern of Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. So it's always meant to be a blessing to all people. So this isn't something new. So if you are thinking about, like, what's the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament? There are totally some, there's a lot of discontinuity between them, I believe anyway. I'm not going to get up here and explain all of that to you. You might have your own opinions on that, but there's definitely some break, but at least one area of similarity is that God's love and blessing has always been meant for all people. Always been meant for all people. So the gospel is still to be a blessing to all nations. If I was to summarize everything that we've looked at so far, I would say that a good way to summarize this passage is that we must proclaim the gospel again and be waiting for the results. That's not in your notes, but I think that's one of the most important things for us to understand. So this kind of brings us to the question, like, what are we going to do about it? You might be, like, tracking with me so far. You're like, yeah, Andrew, the gospel, you know, does crazy things. We should be repeating it. It's not different than it's always meant to be. I'm tracking with that. Let's talk about what we are going to do about it. I think that God's word is provocative, not in the way that Will Ferrell is famous for saying in Blades of Glory that it's provocative. Not in that way provocative, but provocative in that it provokes a response. Provocative in that it provokes a response, and our response to the gospel and God's word should be something. So if you guys don't do anything from here today, it either means that I didn't maybe proclaim the gospel very well, maybe I proclaimed something else, or maybe because you're not being sensitive enough to what that gospel is asking you to change in your life. Up to this point, you've had really cute little blanks in your notes where you can write in words that I have underlined, but at this time, you're not going to be writing down the things that I put up here. You could. But that's not what I'm going to recommend to you guys. I'm going to be listing off a bunch of applications, ramifications of what the gospel means to us as Silverton First Baptist, to us as church believers here in our American context. And I want you guys to be thinking, not what does this passage mean to me, but knowing that the passage is what, hopefully, what Andrew just proclaimed it to be, what needs to change in my life. Because when I read this passage and I was convicted from it, the same thing that needs to change in how I live my daily life probably isn't the same thing that needs to change in your life. For example, I wake up and I go to school and then I come and sit in that office and then I may or may not hang out with high schoolers and middle schoolers later. Zach, for example, doesn't do any of that. He wakes up earlier than me and then goes all the way to this weird windy place called the Dalles. I don't know why they do that, but that's what they do, and his life looks different. So of course the application needs to look different. But first, what are we going to do about it? We're going to proclaim the gospel, right? That's what Paul was doing. That's what made the church grow. And so we're going to proclaim the gospel. And I think the way that we should do this is in the way that Jesus said we should do it in his thesis statement, really, in Acts 1:8, to Jerusalem, to Judea, and Samaria, and the rest of the earth. If you take that really literally, Judea and Samaria and Jerusalem have already been done, so at least we need to do it to the ends of the earth. If you take it literally in that sense, which I think that's what Jesus was meaning, and I've heard that idea kind of twisted and translated in so many different ways, and I don't really like it, but I think a better way to at least kind of paraphrase what Jesus is saying in that is that perhaps a better way is, first, you should do yourselves. Jerusalem would have been like the Jews of the Jews, the best people, right? The best of the Jews, that's where they would have been. And if anybody, they should have known better. They were the holders and keepers of God's word, and they should have known better. They should have been able to recognize Jesus. So he's like, dude, take it to the people that should be most receptive of the gospel first. Take it to them first. And then you should take it to, like, the rest of the people that are, like, pretty similar to them. Not quite the same. Judea would have been like, what Jesus would have been saying is like the rest of Israel. So to bring it to Jerusalem and then the rest of Israel. And then he says to bring it to all nations. And I think a good way of like saying, how does this fit for us in our context? Is that we need to preach the gospel to ourselves first. We're the Jerusalem. I think that one of the greatest travesties, maybe that's a hard way to put it, but one of the things that we've lost through our American evangelism movement is that we now view the gospel as a mere tool for salvation, and we don't view it as anything else. I didn't put this in my notes. It's in your guys' little thing that you use after Sunday, what they call life group questions. So now I'm giving you guys answers. I'm cheating. But we often view the gospel as the diving board into faith, the diving board into the swimming pool of faith. Do you guys all flip to the back and you're going to like write the answers? I think I hear faith returning. That's okay, you can do that. But that's not the way it should be. Faith should be the diving board into the pool of the gospel. Faith should be us to be able to trust that what the gospel declares is true and right and correct and godly and the only thing that can provide for our lives. And we should live every day submersed in the gospel. It shouldn't be just something that we like, or, oh, I prayed a prayer and I trust the gospel. No, the gospel declares who you are. The gospel decides how you interact with that person in front of you in the line at Safeway that's annoying you. The gospel declares how you interact with your friends and when they don't trust the gospel. The gospel declares how you interact at work, what job you're going to choose, and how to best provide for your family. The gospel decides absolutely everything about you. I'm not making this up. We see this in Romans 1:15. I've become really familiar with Romans because I've been teaching our students it. And we see in Romans 15 the most peculiar thing, and I think it's very stretching for us in our American context. And in 1:15, Paul says, I am eager to preach the gospel to you. He's writing to a church in Rome, one of the bigger churches that have had a lot of believers for a while. And he says, I am eager to preach to you the gospel. So, of course, the gospel is meant for believers. It's what grows you. It's what changes you to be more like God. It is nothing else but the gospel. We look at Romans 12:1. I think that if there's ever like one verse that I could just give someone and it would like hopefully summarize everything else in the Bible, it's Romans 12:1, and it says that I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercies, to give your life as a living sacrifice. What does that in view of God's mercies mean? Does it mean, I don't know, what else could it mean? The only thing it can mean is the gospel, that Jesus died for us. The gospel that the Son of God had to come all the way down from heaven to earth to be a lowly human. Okay, if that wasn't enough, live a perfect life that was extremely challenging because he was human and was tempted in so many different ways. And then when he lived that perfect life, of all people, he should be the one who doesn't die, but then dies a horribly painful death that we deserve as sinners. He got up on the cross and was nailed to it when we deserved it and died that death. And then proving he was God, who he said he was, rose from the grave and ascended into heaven and left us with a helper to be able to live out that life. Of course, that is what should motivate us in everything. If you came to church today and your motivation is something else besides you want to be submersed in the gospel, that you want to be learning from the gospel, that you want the gospel to be what changes you, if your motivation is not God's mercies, then I think that we're missing something. And second, we should be bringing the gospel to God's people. Like I'm trying my darndest right now to do for you. Bring the gospel to you in a way that edifies you, encourages you, and spurs you on, like in Hebrews 10:25. Hebrews says that we should be doing for each other. We should be growing each other in the gospel. This isn't in my notes, and now I'm starting to get a little ramped up. But there's this famous old ancient dude that was a minister, is what they called him. I don't know, so long ago. This is in my notes. This is why I'm having a hard time remembering it. But maybe you've heard this story before. I think there's only one guy to do this. But in order to become sanctified by God, he wanted to be removed from the distractions of the world. So he put himself onto a 6-meter pole. He climbed up the pole and he stayed up there. And some of you guys that are like business owners or logistical thinkers are like, how did he stay up on top of the pole? How did he get food and like do the thing you need to do after you eat food? Well, there was like literally like a lever pulley system that he was able to have someone come and change those things for him. He's kind of a weirdo. But then there are people that would like stop by and he was still reachable. He was still reachable to people, and as they'd walk by, they'd be like, hey, guy, you want to talk? And he was like, no, I don't like people. And so he built his pole eventually 25 meters into the
air. That's a quarter of a football. It's actually longer than a quarter of a football field, but really close. That's an approximation, a quarter of a football field in length away from people. That's not how God has designed our relationship with believers. The gospel should be so penetrating into our lives that we need to share it with our other believers. So when we see our other believers going astray from what the gospel says that they should be doing with their lives, we should be holding each other accountable, not just in this way that, like, I'm going to correct you, but also in not like this corrective way, but also in this preventive way. Like, before you go down that road, let me share the gospel with you. It should be something that we do all the time for each other as believers. We see Paul doing that when he wants to bring the gospel to the Romans. And then at that point is when we bring the gospel to other people. And how often do we skip step one and two and we just start sharing who God is to other people? But we haven't let the gospel penetrate our own lives, and we haven't let the gospel penetrate our believers in our church as well. We never see at any time, I don't think so anyway, a believer going out by himself to carry out God's ministries in the Bible. No, he always went at least with another person. And they went out in pairs, and a lot of times they still had other believers in the area. They just, like, traveled down each road in pairs. Like, we see in this passage when Paul was picked up after being stoned, he was picked up by many disciples. He never went out by himself. The gospel should be an outflow of our own personal growth. The second thing that we should do about it is expect contrasting results. Within a few hours at least, we don't get a time frame of this different gospel preaching in our passage, but within a few hours, we see some people be very accepting of the gospel and very rejecting of the gospel. And we should be expecting those results. We should be expecting that same contrast. And when we don't expect either one, in our minds, we're taking away from the power of the gospel for people to not only reject it, but accept it. And so we can use this to evaluate. Are people accepting the gospel here in our church? Are people coming to faith? If not, then maybe we're not doing it right or something. Maybe. I don't think it's a hard, fast rule that we can just look back every time and say that we're not doing that right, that one gospel dynamic. But if we're proclaiming the gospel, this should be happening. It's like when you don't see fruit in a believer's life, you don't go, they're not saved, but you should be doing the opposite, not the negative of it, but the positive of it, and be saying that when you are a believer, you should be seeing that fruit. So if we're proclaiming the gospel, we should be seeing acceptance. Are people rejecting and persecuting us in our church? If not, maybe we're not preaching the gospel right. Maybe we're not proclaiming the gospel. Maybe we're not doing it strong enough to provoke this rejection that the Bible says that we should be seeing. Doesn't mean that every single time that we preach the gospel that we're going to get one of these things. But if we take a long enough sample, we should be seeing both of these things in the way that we proclaim the gospel. And I think what is so important to get from this passage, and I want you guys to hear it from what I'm saying and not hear it for anything else. Please, please trust in the words I'm saying and not hear it for something else. But I think there is a huge tendency, and I would be scared for us to do this, for us to take the current climate of the church and Christians in America and how so many people don't like us. I've heard so many horrible stories about what people have interactions with Christians, and take that as like, oh, we're preaching the gospel right, we're getting the persecution. I don't think that this is what that passage is communicating at all. I don't think it's to look at that we've been persecuted in some way and be like, oh, it's because we're proclaiming the gospel correctly. It could be sometimes, but I know that persecution that I've gotten in my own lives from other people being like, dude, why are you doing that as a Christian? It's usually, not usually, but sometimes it's not because I'm proclaiming the gospel. It's because I'm just being a bad neighbor. And I had a classmate ask this, and I thought it was really provoking, thought-provoking. And he said that Christians, or he didn't say this, but he said, when was the last time you heard someone say, Christians are the nicest people, too bad they think that some old guy died and then like crawled out of a cave and jumped up into heaven. Like, no, the part of the gospel, that's the part that we should be persecuted for, that we think Jesus is divine. That's really where the persecution should come from. And I don't think that it's always where we get our persecution. So I just warn us from leaping to the current climate of how people view us in our culture as saying that, oh, we preach the gospel just fine. I just don't think that that's what the passage is saying. And Zach spoiled it for you. But the third one is proclaim the gospel. So we're doing it again. Don't stop proclaiming the gospel. Do it. When your wayward niece or nephew or family member comes and hangs out with you at Thanksgiving for dinner, instead of correcting their obedience to God, just share with them the gospel. Their obedience and proclaiming how they should be living, following rules, is never going to save them, is never going to change their soul internally. That is always from the truth of the gospel and understanding it and believing it. Those are the two things that change us spiritually. So if you care for that person, instead of correcting their behavior, help their heart with the gospel. This isn't some like hippie thing that I've been indoctrinated by. It's in the Bible. That's what we've all need to be doing, is shaping people through the gospel. And what I think is a really good reminder is that we as Christians are often guilty of prescribing to people a different medication than the one that healed us. What healed all of us in this room is the truth of the gospel. It's not because we picked ourselves up by our bootstraps and tried harder. It's the gospel, and because we don't always understand and entrust the gospel enough in our lives, what we do is we often push and prescribe a different kind of medicine on people. We say that if you just stop sleeping with your boyfriend, if you just stopped having that opinion on some topic, if you just changed the way you lived your life, it would be okay. And I think that that's dangerous and scary, but no, we should be proclaiming the gospel and allow that to be shaping their behavior. And I think that fundamentally, the problem of why we don't always proclaim the gospel as much as we should is because we don't understand and trust the gospel enough in our lives. Again, if there is one thing, if you throw that up, it should be the next slide. Yeah. The one thing that I want you guys to walk away with this from is that this passage tells us that we must proclaim the gospel again. Again assumes, presupposes that we've already done it before. So we need to be doing it in our lives daily. We need to be doing it with our community daily, and we need to be doing it with other people every time that we get the opportunity to, and be waiting for the results, to be expecting miraculous acceptance, and at the same time, be so ready for radical rejection. I'm going to go ahead and invite the worship team up. If you haven't already written something in that area of application, those two, three things where I didn't write lines so that you could fill out, go ahead and do that. But I intentionally put worship at the end of our gathering today because I wanted it to be a response to the gospel. And the same way that I'm asking all of us here to have a response to the gospel in our lives, I'm asking that right now you guys stand. Go ahead and do that stand. If you're able to.